You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey, you're listening to Rock and Or Roll. I'm BJ. So, I was watching this limited series on the Peacock app called The Resort, created by Andy Sierra, who wrote the time warp film Palm Springs, starring Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti. Milioti is also in The Resort. And I liked Palm Springs a lot. The Resort, not so much. So the basic premise of the show is, quote, an anniversary trip puts a marriage to the test when a couple finds themselves embroiled in one of Yucatan's most bizarre unsolved mysteries from 15 years prior, involving the disappearance of two young adults, a murder, and a once-in-a-century hurricane. With everything connected, solving the crime requires unraveling some of life's biggest questions. So yeah, I can't say I recommend watching The Resort, but it was worth it for me, because while I was watching, I heard this song, a folky song with great harmony vocals. I think it was near the beginning of one of the episodes, and I really liked it. So I Googled some of the lyrics that I was hearing, and I discovered that it was a song by Brewer and Shipley. Brewer and Shipley, of course, are most famous for the ridiculous, oddball hit One Toke Over the Line.
One toke, man. One toke over the line. Downtown at a railway station. One toke over the line.
I've investigated many, many artists over the years. Used to buy records for a dollar in the 90s just to check things out. You know, I was buying records by bands that I ended up really not liking at all, like Poco, for example, but I would just buy stuff to hear it, like Garland Jeffries, and end up not liking it. But they were a buck, and before the internet, that was really the only way to check a lot of stuff out. But I never bothered checking out Brewer and Shipley. I was just never curious enough to delve into the catalog. Based on One Toke Over the Line, that did not inspire me to dig any deeper. I certainly flipped past their records 1,000 times since the 90s, and I just wasn't intrigued enough to check them out. But then I heard this song in the year 2022, more than 50 years after it was released, and I realized I needed to check out Brewer and Shipley, because this song, People Love Each Other, is great. Then I thought, well, if I'm going to delve into the Brewer and Shipley catalog, why not do a podcast episode? So here we are. Thomas Shipley was born on April 1, 1941 in Mineral Ridge, Ohio. He played trumpet in high school, but turned it in for a guitar after hearing Pete Seeger and falling in love with folk music of the time. While in college, Tom played open mic nights at various beatnik coffee houses, and after college, he hit the road and played the American folk circuit, including venues in Canada. Michael Brewer was born April 14th, 1944, in Oklahoma City. The oldest of four children, he performed on the radio at the ripe age of four. He was a singing drummer in a rock and roll band in high school, but in 1960 he sold his drums and bought his first guitar, a Martin D-18. After graduating from high school in 1962, he traveled the same folk circuit as Tom Shipley, performing in coffee houses from coast to coast, and Michael Brewer started writing his own songs. So he met Tom Shipley in 1964 at the Blind Owl Coffee House in Kent, Ohio, but they would not become a team for a few more years. Brewer actually formed a different duo with a guy named Tom Maston. They started playing together in 1965 and settled in San Francisco and then Los Angeles. They actually landed a recording contract with Columbia Records as Maston and Brewer. They had a band. They had a drummer named Billy Mundy, who was later a member of Frank Zappa's Mothers of Invention, and a bass player named Jim Fielder, who was later a founding member of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Maston and Brewer toured Southern California. They opened for bands like The Birds and a newly formed band called Buffalo Springfield. Buffalo Springfield actually formed in a house next door to where Michael Brewer lived, a house that was once owned by Lenny Bruce. And Buffalo Springfield actually took their name from a roadwork vehicle that they saw parked in front of Michael Brewer's house next door. So Maston and Brewer were headlining clubs in L.A. and recording songs for Columbia. All of a sudden, Tom Maston decided that he just couldn't take the pressure of everything, and they split up, and sadly, years later, Tom Maston committed suicide. So the guy that had signed Maston and Brewer to Columbia Records was actually leaving that company to help create a new record company that was being formed by Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss to be called A&M Records. And so he took Michael with him to A&M, and Michael Brewer became a staff songwriter for A&M's publishing company, Good Sam Music. Now, during this time, Tom Shipley and Michael Brewer had developed a friendship. They kept crossing paths on the folk circuit, and Tom Shipley eventually drifted to L.A. in 1967 to check out that emerging West Coast scene. And so he knocked on Michael Brewer's door, and then he ended up renting a house around the corner. Tom's next-door neighbor at the time was actually Jim Messina, who was in Buffalo Springfield and later of Loggins and Messina. So soon enough, Tom Shipley got hired by A&M as a staff writer as well, and he actually recorded a single with Ruth Ann Friedman under the group named The Garden Club. So Tom Shipley is splitting time writing songs with Friedman in David Crosby's basement, but he also started writing songs with his neighbor Michael Brewer. As staff songwriters for A&M, Brewer and Shipley wrote songs that were recorded by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, H.P. Lovecraft, and Bobby Rydell. But it was their demos that they recorded for the publishing company that actually started getting attention at the record label. And it was suggested that they start recording their own songs for release. And so their first album as Brewer and Shipley, so Michael Brewer had graduated from the number two name on the bill in Maston and Brewer to the number one name on the bill in Brewer and Shipley. Their first album for A&M, Down in L.A., came out in 1968 and included the song Truly Right, which was the song they wrote that was recorded and released by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. So the Down in L.A. album isn't great. It includes some generic folk songs like Small Town Girl and hippie shit like Dreamin' in the Shade and Love, Love. She Thinks She's a Woman is really bad. My favorite songs from the first Brewer and Shipley album, Down in L.A., would be I Can't See Her, An Incredible State of Affairs, and Keeper of the Keys.
Tomorrow, and I find her there. sounds good, but she's still the same old story. She thinks she's deceiving me. She thinks I can't see her. She thinks I can't see. All the love that I know, turning out not to be.
Possibly see the keeper of all the keys. One key to rule them he keeps in the great hall under the dark tower we call. Now we beat on the drum, a query and answers come. And now the children the oracle has seen play at the old gates of his dreams. And he doesn't even realize, he doesn't realize that it's all happening to let him know there's a change coming up behind him. But it's hanging on to the chains and the key that binds him.
So A&M had brought in some really good musicians to play on the Down in L.A. album, like Jim Messina and Leon Russell. But even with a soon-to-be-released debut album and mutual friends who were starting to make it big in bands like The Byrds, Buffalo Springfield, and The Association, Michael and Tom really didn't like their life in Los Angeles. And so they decided to move back to the Midwest as soon as the album was finished. So by the time the album came out in October 1968, Brewer and Shipley were living in Kansas City. Tom Shipley described their decision to settle in Missouri as one of, quote, fortunate circumstance. Quote, there was a music scene built up in Kansas City, and Michael and I used to come during Christmas, and it was great. There would be clouds in the sky. You don't see clouds in L.A., just the haze. A quote from Michael Brewer, we really didn't care for L.A. very much. We had just had enough, and figured there had to be a better way to make music, without living there. So we left California, and ended up coming back to the heartland. We ended up in Kansas City and started a management production company with some friends, Good Karma Productions. Our management went to the East Coast to shop some labels. Buddha signed us, because Neil Bogart, who was the president of Buddha Records at the time, was known as the King of Bubblegum. You know, 19 Dead Fruit Company and all that stuff. He was trying to shatter that image and looking for album artists. And that's what Tom and I were. We were never about singles. Every song on our albums was just as important as the next one. So Brewer and Shipley were actually signed to Kama Sutra, which was an offshoot label of Buddha Records. So Buddha was the parent company. And they released 4 albums in 4 years with Kama Sutra. Weeds, Tarkio, Shake Off the Demon, and Rural Space. So the album Weeds, their second album, came out in 1970, includes the song that inspired this episode, People Love Each Other, and a few other songs I like, especially Indian Summer and Oh Sweet Lady. Now, it was Brewer and Shipley's third album, Tarkio, or Tarkeo, however you pronounce it. That was the album that included the ridiculous One Toke Over the Line. Jerry Garcia actually played steel guitar on the song, supposedly. One Toke Over the Line was a top 10 hit in 1971. So the definition of a toke is, quote, inhalation of a marijuana cigarette or pipe smoke. Eventually, toke just became slang in America for smoking a marijuana cigarette. It might have been derived from the Spanish word tocar, which meant, quote, touch, tap, or hit. So this is Michael Brewer's account of the origins of the song. Quote, one day we were pretty much stoned and all. One day we were pretty much stoned and all. And Tom says, man, I'm one toke over the line tonight. I liked the way that sounded, and so I wrote a song around it. But it wasn't meant to be a serious song, and they used it as a warm-up tune backstage. They never really considered playing it live. It was never really meant to see the light of day. But while they were in the process of recording the album, they landed a gig opening for Melanie at Carnegie Hall. And so they were still busy arranging and finishing up the songs for the new record and weren't really ready to perform them. And they hadn't really rehearsed their old stuff enough. And so they basically ran out of material. And so when the crowd gave them an encore, when they opened for Melanie, they didn't know what to play. And one song that they could play was One Toke Over the Line. So they played that. This is the story, at least. And as it happened, Neil Bogart, president of Buddha Records, parent company to Kama Sutra, and of course Neil Bogart ended up going on to start Casablanca Records and signed Kiss, and also Casablanca was responsible for a lot of disco during the disco craze. Anyways, Neil Bogart was in the audience at Carnegie Hall, and when he heard One Toke Over the Line, he told the guys, "You gotta record it. You gotta put it on the album." Well, Neil Bogart was the boss. He was in charge, so they recorded it and they put it on the album. And then Bogart decided he wanted to release it as a single. So now not only was it on the album, it was on the radio. Now the song did crack the top 10, but it might have gone even higher, except that radio stations started banning the song. They were actually getting pressure from the FCC. And the irony is that the guys have always maintained that the song is actually about using moderation, hence the words over the line. Neil Bogart actually complained to Rolling Stone magazine about the FCC interference, and Ben Fong Torres ended up writing an article about the controversy for Rolling Stone. Whatever the FCC meant to do when it issued its public notice regarding the broadcast of dope lyrics, the immediate results are clear. Rock stations, AM and FM, are scared shitless. Interpreting the commission's indirectly worded notice as a warning to ban all pro-drug songs, many station managers have appointed themselves censors and are pulling dozens of songs. And depending on their ears and the amount of space between them, the results have been funny, not so funny, and quite often, frightening. The first major casualty is a good example of the mentalities set loose by the FCC. One Toke Over the Line, a single by Brewer and Shipley that had been cleared by the trades and programming tipsters and began a steady cruise up the charts, until the FCC issued its reminder, FCC's word, to broadcasters to know the meaning of songs that, quote, tend to glorify or promote the use of illegal drugs such as marijuana, LSD, speed, etc. Now, at least half a dozen top 40 stations have dropped the single because of the word toke. "I frankly didn't know what toke was," said Jeff Kay, program director of WKBW in Buffalo. "So we did a street survey, and 90% of the kids said it had to do with marijuana. So Kay dropped the song, along with White Rabbit, DOA by Bloodrock, Monkey Man by the Stones, and 8 Miles High," which Roger McGuinn has always maintained was a song about a plane trip to London. "The blacklisted song," said Kay, "went beyond the boundaries of good taste." One Toke is on Buddha Records, and Neil Bogart, president of the label, sounded pained as he rolled off the list of stations banning his record. KFJZ in Fort Worth, where it was number 6, KLIF in Dallas, where it was number 18, WFUN in Miami, and WKBW in Buffalo. "If airways fully belong to the people," Bogart asked, "how do you justify pulling a record that's so heavily requested by the people?" Tom Shipley, who wrote the song with Mike Brewer, issued a crisp statement. "In this electronic age, pulling a record because of its lyrics is like the burning of books in the 30s. Brewer in Boston explained the song, which is more about waiting for a train than anything connected to dope.
This is an insidious and underhanded form of censorship, said Tracy Weston, a former administrative aide to the FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson, the only dissenter in the issuance of the notice, because the FCC has not had the guts to come out and say what they really mean. They are trying to scare private stations into doing the censorship themselves and avoid the rap. Elsewhere, most broadcasters said they've been following anti-hard drug lines before the FCC notice and that they neither needed nor welcomed the reminder. In New York, novelist Jerome Weedman, president of the Authors League of America, wrote the FCC on behalf of lyricists, publishers, and record companies, and lyrics that, quote, are fully entitled to the protection of the First Amendment.
The song took Brewer and Shipley on quite a roller coaster ride in 1971. President Richard Nixon labeled Brewer and Shipley, quote, public miscreants. Not to be outdone, corrupt Vice President Spiro Agnew, soon to be disgraced, declared them on national TV to be subversive to American youth. He called the song blatant drug culture propaganda that threatened to, quote, sap our national strength.
Good evening. At 5 minutes after two this afternoon, Vice President Agnew resigned. His one-sentence letter of resignation to the Secretary of State made Agnew the second man in history to quit the nation's second-highest office, but the first to do so under a cloud of scandal. Outside the federal courthouse in Baltimore, Agnew gave his reasons.
But I believe it would be against the national interest, have a brutalizing effect on my family to go through a long 2-year struggle concerning this matter. You also may be aware of what I said in open court, that I categorically and flatly deny the assertions that have been made by the prosecutors with regard to their contentions of bribery and extortion on my part.
The song actually reportedly earned the duo a place on the infamous Richard Nixon's enemies list, which Mike Brewer calls a badge of honor. Of course, in the very early 70s, not everyone knew what the word toke meant. This is how the song ended up being performed on the extremely tame Lawrence Welk show. After the performance, Welk called it a modern spiritual.
Thank you very much. Now, here's an attractive couple, Gail Farrell from Durand, Oklahoma, Dick Dale from Algona, Iowa. Excuse me, let's listen to Gail and Dale and one of the newer songs.
One toke over the line, sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line. Waiting for the train that goes home, sweet Mary, hoping that the train is on time. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line. Who do you love? I hope it's me. I've been changing, as you can plainly see.
I felt the joy and I learned about the pain
that my mama said. If I should choose to make a part of me, would surely strike me dead. And now I'm one toke over the line, sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line. Waiting for the train that goes home, sweet Mary, hoping that the train is on time. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line. One toke over the line, sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line.
Don't you know that we're away?
Waiting for the train that goes home, sweet Mary, hoping that the train is on time. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line.
Don't you know that we're a
sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke.
one joke over the line.
And there you heard A Modern Spiritual by Gail and Dale.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
One Toke Over the Line is, I guess, catchy, but it's also ridiculous, and I can't imagine seriously listening to it at this point. But there are some good songs on the Tarkeo album. My favorites would be The Light, Can't Go Home, and Seems Like a Long Time, written by Theodore Anderson and covered by Rod Stewart for his breakout album, Every Picture Tells a Story.
The light within me shineth, the life within me flows. I'll sing a song of the kingdom, and hope the spirit grows. There was a man from midnight who lived while on the road. A light was his possession. It was a heavy load. He wrapped it all in color, but left the binding free for those who felt the hunger and truly longed to see. The winds, they did not fail, and all across the country
WTAP.
Brewer and Shipley's fourth album, Shake Off the Demon, was released by Buddha in 1971 and is probably my favorite album by Brewer and Shipley. The title track is really great, and I also like Message from the Mission and When Everybody Comes Home.
Children ride for the compromise.
The guys released one more album with Kama Sutra or Buddha in 1972 called Rural Space. My picks would be When the Truth Finally Comes and Crested Butte.
Let go. When the truth
So after this, the guys moved on to a deal with Capitol Records, and in 1974, they came out with an album called ST-11261, produced by John Boylan, who would soon earn a co-production credit on the debut Boston album. Brewer and Shipley had produced themselves for the last couple of albums. This album isn't great, but I do like the song Look Up, Look Out a lot. And How Are You is also a good one.
Sleepless night.
The last Brewer and Shipley album of the classic era, Welcome to Riddle Bridge, was released by Capitol in 1975.
Take me home. Dream me along where my pieces fit and faces are known.
So even though they didn't put out any more records, Brewer and Shipley continued playing together for about five more years. But in 1980, after more than a decade of writing, recording, traveling, and performing, they amicably parted ways. A quote from Michael Brewer, "There was no big breakup. We'd been on the road for too many years. It almost killed us. We were burned out," Tom Shipley agreed. So Michael Brewer continued to make music. He recorded a solo album for Dan Fogelberg's Full Moon Records in 1983 called Beauty Lies. Tom Shipley started working as a television producer and director and eventually formed his own production company, which he named after the One Toke Over the Line album, Tarkeo Communications. Shipley later founded the Oral History of the Ozarks Project, a nonprofit organization that produces documentaries about life in the Missouri Ozarks. In 1987, at the request of a Kansas City radio station, Brewer and Shipley reunited for a concert to celebrate the station's first birthday and were overwhelmed when they walked out on stage to 10,000 cheering fans welcoming their return. So they started writing together again, and their first project was the soundtrack for one of Tom's documentaries, Treehouse, an Ozark Story. Since reuniting in 1987, Brewer and Shipley have released two more albums, Shanghai and Heartland. They continue to perform live as a duo. Shipley was the manager of the video department at the Missouri University of Science and Technology until he retired. Michael Brewer continues to write songs and has released three more solo albums. And of course, People Love Each Other was recently featured in The Resort on Peacock, which inspired my fandom and this episode. So, the music lives on.
Now, you mixed in some wonderful circles in the 60s and 70s. The list of names that played on your albums and who you shared the stage with is quite impressive. You must look on that with pride.
Yes, I do. I'm sure Tom does, too. Well, you know, you can't be a working musician traveling all the time, pretty much, and performing and not run into a lot of other people, you know, and share stages with a whole lot of other people, you know, one way or the other. So yeah, we've been very blessed. We've gotten to share the stage with a lot of people performing. We've also been blessed with having a lot of excellent musicians contribute to our albums. So yeah, we've been very fortunate. I think back on that quite fondly.
Any standout memories there with some particular names?
Oh gosh, it would be hard after 35 years of it. You know, it's kind of hard to pick and choose the best ones. Sometimes the smallest ones are the ones that stand out, you know. I mean, as opposed to a 20,000-seat stadium or something.
Sure.
Although there are a few of those also. But the thing that blows my mind is way back when, some of the people we shared stages with, they opened for us before they were superstars. I mean, Bruce Springsteen opened for us. Linda Ronstadt opened for us. So yeah, that's pretty. Billy Joel opened for us. So that's kind of funny to me.
Did make quite a name for yourself, supporting some major names. Was it difficult at times in those support act type situations to win the attention of the audience who were there to see the main attraction, so to speak?
With us being the supporting act?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, many times, but one in particular comes to mind. We did a 28-city tour in 28 nights, opening for Jethro Tull, when their Passion Play album, it was just coming out. And as you probably know, Jethro Tull is very theatrical. There's a whole lot to their show. Well, we were playing, you know, 20,000-seat arenas, and nothing was working right at all with their show. I mean, they had to go back to doing their Thick as a Brick show and stuff because none of their special effects were working. It was a fiasco. But the thing was, though, these are huge theaters, and we had to, well, not theaters, stadiums. We had to go on at 8, and we had to be off at 8:30. And we even had a band, by the way. It wasn't just the two of us as an acoustic duo.
Okay.
But the lights were still on in these huge places. There were thousands of people already in there, but thousands more were still filing in, you know, finding their seats and stuff. So it was just crazy. I don't think, and they were so far away, too, most of them. And we're not theatrical. We don't jump around the stage. We're folk singers. So I don't think a lot of those people ever even realized that there were live human beings on the stage, except for the ones shooting Roman candles and throwing lit railroad flares and sparklers and stuff like that. It was chaos every night, 28 cities in a row. It was nuts.
Goodness. I believe you also opened.
We did get paid, though.
Oh, good. I believe you opened for Black Sabbath at one point, too. Is that right?
Yes, that's another one that stands out in my memory. It was in Chicago, in the Chicago Stockyards Coliseum, and Peter Frampton was still with them. And we opened for oh, no, I'm sorry. I was thinking of, who was Peter Frampton with?
Humble Pie.
I can't remember. Humble Pie, there you go. There was another one. Yeah, the only time in our entire careers we were booed off stage. We were just the wrong opening act for Humble Pie and the mood of the audience. So we left the stage. Well, we no sooner get back to the dressing room, and the promoter comes out looking at his watch going, well, you guys haven't played long enough. You got to go back out there. And he forced us to go back out, and we had to go back out. And I literally ran to the microphone and asked the audience, please, you know, we're being forced to do this. We're not taking an encore. You know, we know you don't like us. You know, we have to do one more song. Don't throw any beer bottles or anything else. So they let us do one more song, and we split. But the other one, Black Sabbath, was in Cleveland, Ohio. I remember that one, too. Yeah, that was crazy. A lot of fireworks that night, too. Our road manager, who was down by the soundboard, had a cherry bomb go off about 4 feet away from his head, so he couldn't hear very well for a couple of days.
I can imagine that would be a real tough audience for a couple of folkies to win over.
Yeah, we always refer to that as creative booking. You know, we never could figure out what were they thinking.
WPIJ in New York.
Thank you very much. That song was from an album we did one time called Weeds. Sort of a planned collector's item, I think. While we're doing, we'd like to do another song from that album. This is a song about our very favorite subject. That's why we like singing. Dirty books. Dirty books. What can I say? Oh, I say. Thank you.
each other. Sure, it's the only way to be. I know you'll soon recall all the things you lost and long to see. He drew circles in the sand, thinking they could shut us out. He drew circles and closed himself inside the lines round about. He doesn't believe it's all the same. He just wants to live until he dies. Playing his circle game, he will lose his life and will not know why.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.